Should I sit closer or?
This is file 47, cycle 3. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is July 31st. I am interviewing Donald Ross, who's going to talk about his background, the Salisbury Forum, and the Salisbury Association trustees, and anything else he wants to talk about. But first, we'll start with, what is your name?
Donald Ross.
And how did you come to buying Hollywood?
Well, I came to it because I was married, and I knew I would be divorced if I didn't agree.
That sounds reasonable. And you came to Salisbury in what year?
I think it was 2012. I should have asked Helen, but she'll remember exactly.
Okay.
Probably 2012.
And which organization did you join first, Salisbury Forum or Salisbury Association?
Oh, Salisbury Forum was the first organization. Actually, I think perhaps the Lake Association was the first one, because our property is on the lake, and then I think the second one was the Salisbury Forum, and then only fairly recently was the Salisbury Association.
I didn't ask you about Lake Wenonskapomic Association, but of course you'd be a member because you have lakefront property.
Correct.
And do you know how much footage you have on the lake?
Well, we actually, when we bought the house, it was 55 feet. That's all. It was a very
narrow.
It came from a triangle. It was like the point of the triangle. But when we bought the field, Dean Meadow, next to it, that added something like 400 feet or something to the property, even though it's essentially, you'd have to do construction to be able to get from the field to the water.
Oh, sure.
It's boggy and muddy and what have you.
There's always these pools that form when it rains.
Yes.
Who invited you to join the Salisbury Forum?
Alex Taylor, who I really look up to as a terrific board member of the Forum. He and Bill Litauer and I were three people who played platform tennis regularly. And Alex, out of the blue, asked me, have you ever gone to a Salisbury Forum event? I said, what's that? Mm-hmm. And then ended up going, I think the first, one of the early ones I saw was the poet who had been the poet laureate for Barack Obama's inauguration.
And, oh, yes.
And he drew a very interesting crowd because it wasn't a pure Northwest Connecticut crowd. It brought people in from New Haven and Hartford and all sorts of other far-flung destinations. Richard Blanco, I think, is his name.
And I'm glad you bring in from the tri-state area, because there's so many very interesting people in the area that it appeals to different sets at a time. Are you? You were on the board now, still?
I'm still on the board. I stepped down in the end of June 2018 from being the president. I had 1 year left in my term to going. I realized that I needed to transition in order to be able to do work on the Salisbury Association. It would have been too much to be trying to do both of those.
Yes.
And so Mary Close Oppenheimer is now the president and will be for, assuming she lives out her term, stays for her full term of, I think, 3 years. And then I am the vice president of the Salisbury Association and will...
Okay.
If all continues to go well, become the president in 2019.
It probably will, but I'm going to stick with Salisbury Forum for just a bit. Did you make any changes when you were on the board?
Well, I think what we did was we basically strengthened things that were already underway. We always had a mailing list, but the mailing list really consisted of just a couple of hundred people at the beginning of the time that I got involved in it. And now we have about 1,000 names, and it wasn't happenstance that that happened. We went out and systematically, there were three or four of us that every time there was an event, we would spread out with holding sort of tablets and allowing people to sign their name and give us their address and so on and so forth. And we ended up increasing substantially the number of people by the time by the end of this season, and we had a significant increase in donations as a result as well. So it was a win-win financially and also for the community that attended the events.
Other than the individuals, have you been trying to get businesses to support it?
Thanks to Alex Taylor, yes. Alex had convened a meeting, may have been, say, 2013, something like that, 14, somewhere back in the days. And he, we had it in the Salisbury Library, a boardroom, on a weekend. I think it probably was a Saturday. And one of the ideas that came out was, why are we not recruiting businesses? Because many of the realtors will tell you when they meet their customers, clients coming in from who aren't aware of Salisbury or Lakeville, and they say to them, well, one of the real features here is there is a program. It's free of charge. It offers speakers from around the country, and there's no other program like it in the northwest corner.
Oh, there isn't. There isn't.
You do have a Kent Library speakers program, but they charge $40 a ticket. That's how they support themselves. And the Kent Presents is about $2,500 a person to attend. It's a two-day event, and it's filled with lots of celebrities. But we are now the, you know, really, I think, significant magnet for bringing people who care about contemporary affairs, care about poetry, care about literature, to come to talks.
With not having a charge, you're going to get more people than if you do $40 a ticket or whatever.
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. And even, I mean, yes, for sure, that, and it's also, we want to do it. We see it as a service and an enrichment to the community.
Oh, it definitely is.
Yeah.
It definitely is. Other than businesses and individuals, when you had a loss in funds, the board members contributed.
We had this year, actually the 2017-18 year, five board members stepped up and put $1,000 each in out, and that just sent a message that we're putting our money in. When most of the people were putting in before that, 100, 200, 250.
We were talking about funding, and other board members putting money in. Have you gotten any money from the Northwest Connecticut Foundation?
We got money from the Northwest Connecticut Foundation, and we also got it from Connecticut Humanities Council. I don't know how much it added up to, but it was several thousand dollars.
And the cost of speakers, how much does it cost for these speakers?
Well, it ranges from zero. There's several speakers who have come, and in fact this year I think two of them have said they're not interested in honoraria, that
good.
They are connected to the community in a larger way, and they want to, you know, make a donation, in effect, of their own.
Wonderful.
So that's a big savings, because the cost of an event runs up towards $3,500, $3,600 when you take ads in the Lakeville Journal, and you pay for the certain amount for the parking. We generally invite newspaper students who are newspaper reporters or editors of their school paper to come to a a dinner if the speaker is going to be there in time. And this year, for example, we had an amazing speaker. The first speaker we had was a man named Steve Coll, C-O-L-L. He's the dean of the journalism school at Columbia University, and his other job is a commentary writer for The New Yorker, where he writes the comment at the beginning of The New Yorker magazine. And he had a title that was phenomenal. The title of the first lecture, and it was Journalism in the Age of Trump, which mm-hmm. drew a huge mm-hmm. audience. And so these students, there were, I think, six editors there sitting waiting, and he came in and he said, "Oh, I'm so embarrassed this is happening, but I turn in my commentary column at, I have to have it in by 7:30, you know, absolute, no, can't delay." Mm-hmm. So all the way up in the car, I've been answering questions, and I may get a few calls here. So you could see the students' eyes open up wide, and sure enough, he had to jump up for two or three calls to mm-hmm. say, you know, what he should do. And so it was a wonderful lesson in journalism.
It's better than if it was scripted.
And we do that. We bring in students from HUSI, from Salisbury School, from Hotchkiss, all to, you know, meet the speaker in an informal setting. And, so it's another way, and we pay for their dinners and stuff, obviously.
What is an honorarium fee?
Well, the honorarium, I'm sorry, I started to answer that. It ranges from nothing when people just do it for free to pretty much tops out at $2,500 per speaker. It's not total. Some are $2,000, mm-hmm. some will take $1,500, and it really just depends on
the person.
It's the person, and it's also... kind of in a sense, in some ways, when we were losing money one year, we looked to, in fact, we canceled one, decided not to have a final speaker because it would have saved something like $3,000 or so. Plus.
Well, you have to look at the bottom line.
Right.
Where do you hold these?
We hold them in three locations, the Housatonic Regional Valley High School Auditorium, which mm-hmm. holds over 500, Hotchkiss Walker Auditorium, which holds 600, and Salisbury School's auditorium, which holds about 375, I think. And this year, when we totaled up rough estimates of the crowds, and we had, I think, five speakers, I think we only had a total of about 190 empty seats for all of those. They were full houses.
That's wonderful.
It
proves that
yes.
There's a need. And you get your speakers through networking, I'm assuming.
It's networking, people who know people. So I had worked with a New York Times reporter up in Albany, as when she was and I were both much younger, and I fed her some information about environmental stuff that I was working on, and she would occasionally write it up, etc. And so she's now a well-known author and wrote the book The Sixth Extinction. Betsy Colbert is her name, or Elizabeth Colbert, but Betsy, and she was the first person I called, and I called her, and she said, "Yeah, I'll come down. I live and work in Williamstown. I mean, it's not a big trip. I'm happy to come down."
Oh, lovely!
Love to be there.
Wonderful.
Gave a terrific talk. Totally sold out. And
oh, yeah.
In fact, we had to move people who were trying to sit on the stairs and block because of fireworks.
Yeah, I know about that one.
Yes, it was a great event, so it was exciting.
Oh, sure. Well, it would be. It would be. This is something that's been going on for several years, and it's still fascinating topics, and people come out. And the more that it goes on, the more widely known it becomes.
Yes.
How many events do you have a year?
Well, it ranges. We have two different kinds of events. One is a movie that we have in January or sometimes the very beginning of February, just to sort of the winter season. Mm-hmm. And it's on a Sunday. We do it at the Millagen Movie House, and it's a very good relationship between us. Yeah. And then in June, we have the Civic Life Series, and those are short films put on by students in various schools, Civic Life Theory Series, and they run 8 minutes, 7 minutes, 9 minutes, and they're all done, shot by students, on serious topics. Mm-hmm. They're all, they go out, they research, they interview, they cut, they film, and two of the board members of the Salisbury Forum have historically gone out and helped them. One had been a TV filmmaker and actually on the air spokesperson, Bill LaTower. And Frank Fitzmaurice taught journalism and at American University, and so he has been doing it. And Gretchen Babarvik, who had worked for years as the chief aide to Peter Jennings on Channel 7 in New York, she was doing the same thing. So it's
wonderful.
It's the kids are getting great expertise, and they all donate their time and donate their travels to the schools.
And the kids get to have a showcase for what they've produced.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is better than just demonstrating it in the classroom,
right,
or in the school. It gives them,
right,
a wider audience, which is wonderful. And if you have the two films, then do you have...
And then we have anywhere from 5 to... 6 and maybe in an odd year a 7th speaker, but generally 5 to 6 speakers. And we just had unfortunately a cancellation for the first speaker this year because she's a journalist and is off to cover something in Mexico that she had to do. So
life happens.
So we have 3 speakers in the fall, and we'll probably try to have 4 in the spring, which would give us 7 this year.
That's a good number.
Yeah.
It's a good number.
Yeah.
Please tell me the Ralph Nader story. Starting at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, I left New York, actually, to be honest. It was actually before 4 o'clock. It was about 3-something to drive up in a snowy morning to go to Winsted, Connecticut, to pick Ralph up. He was going to speak at the for the forum at the Hoosie Auditorium, but he had wangled an invitation from Hotchkiss that earlier that morning, and so I drove up, I picked him up, we got him to Hotchkiss on time. I sat next to him as we had the principal tell us exactly how much time he was allocated from 9 to 9:25. Students had to go to their classes, and I knew there was trouble coming. But I sat next to the principal, and Ralph was going on, and it was 9:15, 9:20, 9:25, 9:30. I think it was 9:40 or close to it when he stopped. And you could, the principal was, you know, the headmaster. He's not a principal. The headmaster was sort of
having fits.
Yeah, having fits. And and Ralph effortlessly transitioned from that talk to another one that had already been scheduled at 10 o'clock with a group of about 50 or 75 students who had a free period. Spoke to a smaller group after that talk, and then had a meeting with faculty and students for lunch, and again kept going. And then after the lunch, we met with the headmaster, who was the acting headmaster at the time. Mm-hmm. And I sat there. We by then he had sort of forgotten it wasn't a complete catastrophe that the students missed part of their classes. And it was just a delightful talk. And mm-hmm. then he came back and to our house and made notes, talked about things, and then pretty soon a crowd of people came over that we had invited, and he knew was coming, and so he talked all late afternoon, and then had a dinner, and then went, and the Salisbury Forum itself has very strict rules on time.
Mm-hmm.
We have the time, they begin at 7:30, the speakers are told to pretty much try to stop by 8:15, 8:20 or something, so that people can ask questions for 40, 45 minutes. Ralph stopped at going on, it was 9:45 by the time, it was 8:45 by the time Ralph was slowing down. By 9, he had stopped, I guess, and the questions lasted until about 9:45, and I had assumed there'd be a rush of people to come out just because, it's been a long time, and never happened. So finally, he was out sitting in the lobby at well after 10, signing books, mm-hmm. of his books, giving autographs out, etc. And I drove him back up to Winstead. I was dragging. He was animated, and he said, "Well, do you want to come in and talk?" I said, "Ralph, I was up hours before you. I've got to go to sleep." But it was a wonderful, it makes for a great story.
And it's a wonderful experience for so many people.
And I had worked with him for 3 years, so I traveled with him and I knew.
Oh, so you know.
I knew his habits. And
that made a difference.
Yeah.
They're
very close. I mean, I see him, I go up to his tour museum and stuff.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Is there anything that you'd like to add about the Salisbury Forum before we go on to your next organization?
Well, the Salisbury Forum is I think, just a really unique projection envisioned originally by Frank DeChambeau, and who then really put a tremendous amount of work into designing the protocols and how it should be done, and recruiting other people, and then reached out to Salisbury School, and they joined, I think, a year after Hotchkiss had started it, and it's created just a terrific institution that if all continues to work well, there should be no problems in keeping something going, whether it's 4 talks in the fall or 3 talks in the fall, it's going to be a continuing, and word is out among authors and others who are interested. We've actually gotten a few calls on occasion from people saying, I have this person who just wrote this really interesting book on fill in the blank, and would you be interested?
How wonderful.
So there is some unsolicited, because the author will get a fee.
Oh, sure. And they'll also get a lot of popular people, the people that are interested in their topic, which is wonderful.
Yeah, so it's great.
All right, Salisbury Association. It's been going since 1904.
1902. It says on their website.
All right, I don't look at the website. You can tell. Who asked you to join that?
Who asked me to join that? Might have been Tom Key and Dave Heck, who came and sort of, I had known them, bumped into them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they may have been the one who said, "Would you be interested in joining that?" And I said, "Well, what does that involve?" And he said, "Well, we have meetings on Saturday mornings, once a month, and sometimes take a 2-month sabbatical sort of in the summer." And mm-hmm. it has these 3 organizations that are part of it, 3 entities. It's an unusual arrangement because there's Salisbury Land Trust, Salisbury Association Land Trust is the major in terms of financial resources and the number of people who sit on its board as trustees. Then there's the Civic Association that in effect goes out and does things like the 4th of July event at the Grove, but also sponsors other kinds of activities. And
the Fall Festival and the Christmas Concert.
And the Fall Festival, the Christmas Concert, which is always a great talk. And then the third part of it is the... what am I forgetting?
The history!
The history! Oh my God, I'm in trouble.
You certainly are.
I'm in trouble, especially with you interviewing me. I knew. Here I am, I'm looking at your face. And but in any event, the history is a fabulous program, and Lou Bucherri is such a gifted and an inclusive speaker, and is as happy taking 10 students on a Saturday morning to go see some historical monument, the Ames Ironworks or some other kind of thing, and it works. The story that I'm fond of is that I went to the Land Trust meeting, tracks about 500 people, down at Wesleyan College last fall, and they one of the sessions was to talk about how your land trust. So I was in a room with about 30 people, and I'm sitting there, and they went around the room, and they all said, "Well, this is our land trust. This is our land trust." And so I said, "Well, the Salisbury Land Trust actually is three organizations. It's the land trust for sure, but it's also, you know, the historical association and the civic association." And this woman said, "I'm from Fairfield County. Why would you want to do something like that?" And I said, "Well, maybe not in Fairfield County, but
it works in Litchfield.
It works in Litchfield County.
It certainly does.
So it's a really, I think, important institution, and I think could become even stronger. And I think one of the things that I'm hoping that I'll have a chance to do is to try to reach out to other similar civic groups and try to see whether it's worth meeting and seeing whether there is something that we all have in common, where you could, the Lake Association, the Salisbury Forum, and, you know, mm-hmm. six or seven other entities could not think about ways of mutual benefit. So, for example, I met with one of the senior officials at the Sharon Playhouse, and you know, I'm thinking about what that's a, you know, they're really trying to revive that. They had a bad financial situation that they had to make up. Well, why can't some of the other groups help them out? For example, the Salisbury Forum doesn't have any events during the summer. So why don't we send out a mailing to the 1,000 people that are on our mailing list saying, "Hey, there's a great play going on at the Salisbury, at the Sharon Playhouse." It would really, you know, help them out, and, you know, maybe give them a discount, $2 or something, out of, instead of the $20, and the Lake Association can be helpful to people, and begin to see cross-fertilize among some of the organizations that have constituencies. And I think it's important to do that and also look down the age bracket, because the Salisbury Association, I would say, probably has a median age that's well up in the, well, certainly in the low 60s, I would say for sure. There's only a handful of people who are really young, and there's quite a few that are, you know, well past 75.
You have a problem with finding the time to do volunteer organizations.
Yeah, it's very difficult for younger people. Yes,
it's very difficult. When did you join the Salisbury Association?
It was last year.
Okay, so yeah. 17. When you joined the board, did you become a board official? An officer, or
no? I was just a regular, plain vanilla, you know, person sitting at the desk, and then there was the Salisbury Association had a policy until last year of no term limits. I mean, you joined and you could be there for ever. And they began to try to work this out. I think it was a couple of year process.
The accreditation took a long time.
And the accreditation took a long time, but also the sorting out of
policy,
how to change.
Bylaws.
Yeah. Yes, and so I got approached by people who said, would you be interested in becoming more involved in the association? So I said, well, what does that involve? And they said, well, to become an officer. And I said, well, I'm already vice president of the Lake Association, which is a really simple task because Bill the Tower does everything.
I know.
And we only have like 4 meetings a year. And then the Salisbury Forum, which does take up time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to them and thought about it and said yes. And then as I got more interested and involved in it, coming into 2018, and I realized, I should do for Mary Close Oppenheimer what Leon did for me. Leon stepped aside from being president of the Salisbury Forum to give me an opportunity to have a 2-year term. He had had a 5-year term, 6-year term, and then you were off. And and that's actually the same formula that the Salisbury Association now has of
so
six
you
years,
have two 6-year two,
two 6-year
three-year terms.
And then
you have to get off. I mean, you do the 6 years, and then you have to get off, but can come back on.
I believe that's definitely for the forum. I'm not sure if the Salisbury Association does that or not. Probably does. In any event, so I ended up suddenly being, asked to become the vice president of it, and I think partly because of the interpersonal dynamics that in that kind of changeover where you thought you would always be there, and some people have to have term limits now, and they're being moved off the board, and so having somebody who was not involved in any of that process became, I think, helpful.
Yeah, it neutralizes.
I'm a neutral party.
And Chris Brennan will step down 2019 as president.
I think she steps down at the end of 2018. Or maybe at the end of 2018.
Okay.
It's the end.
And then you will become president.
I would become the president, all things
considered
being possible, yeah.
Now, you mentioned a new way of donating funds that was something that you wanted to.
Well, there is a government program that is very advantageous for people that want to provide support for nonprofits. What it does is, if you are over 70 and a half, of which many, many people in this region of the state are, and you have a 401k, a credentialed 401k, at a place like BlackRock or Fidelity or any number of other big institutions and small that do this, you can have a qualified charitable deduction. They call it a QCD. And what that does is it allows you, when you write a check to a nonprofit, let's just say to the Salisbury Association, for say $1,000, and you that's out of your personal checkbook, and you then mail it to Fidelity, I'll just use them as an answer, and ask them to match that with part of your 401k money that you've deposited all those many years of hard work.
You hope.
It is matched, so that instead of giving $1,000, you can give $2,000, or instead of giving $2,000, you could give $4,000 by matching.
Mm-hmm.
The check has to come from you. It has to have the grantee's name on it. here's the advantage. When your money comes out of the normal Fidelity account, you pay tax on it. Mm-hmm. When you're, and this is not some evasive tax plan. The government wants to incent people to help, you know, pay for activities that are nonprofit activities for the civic good. So you can take your $1,000 out of your personal checkbook, match it against a $1,000 that you have in your account, and if you, for some people, they have so much money in their account, they're never going to live to see the last dollar arrive on their desk. And it you know, miraculously doubles the advantage you have.
And you get the tax exempt on the $2,000?
On both. It's a tax exempt occurrence. So the $2,000 comes out, doesn't cost you personally from your check, like you give to a 501c3 nonprofit, that's fine. And this time, it enables you to match, they give you an incentive to match it mm-hmm. by saving the tax money that you would have on your 401k, taxable income you would have to pay if it just came down to you in the normal way.
Oh, okay.
So, and it's nothing, you know, evasive about it.
No.
It's advertised all over the web. It's just no one seems to have used it here. And so I've talked now to both the board of the Salisbury Forum and the Salisbury Association that we ought to try to really encourage that. So the five people, for example, last year mm-hmm. who gave $1,000 to the forum that we spoke about, that could be $10,000.
Yeah.
And that would be basically a third of our operating budget mm-hmm. from five people.
What is TerraCorps?
TerraCorps is another really interesting activity that I think is going to bear tremendous benefits to not just land trusts, the Salisbury Association land trusts, but land trusts in Connecticut. TerraCorps comes, Terra means earth, so it's the Earth Corps, and it's grew out of an AmeriCorps program, that's the sort of domestic peace corps, mm-hmm. the equivalent of the domestic mm-hmm. peace corps, and it was named AmeriCorps up until last year, and it was under the auspices of a large land trust in Massachusetts called the Mount Grace Land Conservation Trust, I think is the name, but Land Conservancy one, something like that. And it's up in Athol, Mass. And what they did was they got volunteers to work on land trust matters, with people who were interested in the environment, interested in climate change. Some of them, most of them are college graduates. Some of them have MAs. Some of them actually took a year off working from their PhD to learn more about managing land. And we are now actively engaged with the TerraCorps group, and we're hoping that in 2019 we will be able to have a Connecticut branch of that. And the way it would work is, assuming nothing changes, is the organization, let's say in this case Salisbury Association, would be able to hire, for example, two TerraCorps volunteers. The rate that you'd pay them would be about, at the present time, about $8,500 a year. They're AmeriCorps people, so they get paid by the federal government mm-hmm. as well. And they work about 1,700 hours a year. So 8,000 sounds like a lot of money, but 1,700 hours of work, if you just try to figure what it would cost to actually yeah. pay that is, and they learn, they generally, frequently they get housing from people that are land trust members who have extra rooms and room over their garage. Their kids are gone from their house and whatever. And we're in active conversations with this, how it's going to happen. And there's now $500,000 that have been pledged from different donors to launch the TerraCore organization. It's spinning off from the Mount Grace Land Trust because it just got to be too big. There's now 38 volunteers working in Massachusetts on it, and they're going to have people in more than that next year in Massachusetts, and we're hoping to bring it down to Connecticut and also to Rhode Island. And the person who's the head of the TerraCore program came and spoke to the Salisbury Association for over an hour, explained all the mechanisms, how it worked, and you know, there were people who had questions and there were some skeptics, I mean, I think, just always. Naturally, but I think it's just an incredible way to, and he had lots of examples. He said, you know, it's not just all going out and, you know, hoeing the field or looking for things. We teach, you know, some of them have master's degrees in environment, ecology, so they can become teach, you know, go in and give talks in schools. They can get students out and take them around and get them involved in doing work on the land, teaching them environment, talking about climate and various things. So I'm really working. I'm actively raising money from foundations to try to help pay for some of these programs.
Wonderful. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the Salisbury Association part of this interview before we close?
That's fine.
That's it?
Yeah, well, Salisbury Association is just a remarkable institution. I mean, the people who are involved in it are just terrific people. And actually, the same is true of the Salisbury Forum. I mean, what happens, I think, is a lot of people think they don't have the time. And when they think they don't have the time, they don't have the time. They just, they don't do it. And
it's a mindset.
And for some people who are still working in Manhattan or somewhere else, it is a problem.
But here it isn't.
Here we have enough people and it's a terrific group. And I think that we can then cross-fertilize. Just like I hadn't ever really known what the Salisbury Association was. I didn't know what the Salisbury Forum was when I started. And it enlarges your sort of network of people you know and work with, and most of them are really class A-plus people because they're putting in hours and hours of time and energy.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Your pen is behind you.